and I like to popularize science. Vaccination against COVID-19 for children aged 5 to 11 has begun. As parents, you may be asking if the vaccine is safe and effective. The answer is yes. The vaccine is approved by Health Canada and has been the subject of numerous studies involving thousands of people, including children. Experts also closely monitor any adverse effects that may occur after vaccination.
For more information, visit quebec.ca/youthvaccine. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.
From Turtle Island to Palestine, occupation is a crime. Free, free Palestine! You're listening to Radio Free Palestine.
Welcome everyone, you are listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Stay tuned.
She was separated from her mother and brother, again a 12-year-old, taken to an interrogation room with her American passport in hand. For several hours, Israeli authorities repeatedly asked her questions like, what is your religion? Why are you here? What's your father's and grandfather's name? Do you have any bombs with you? Are you a suicide bomber? They also asked her where she was from several times, to which she replied, America. And the Israeli soldier responded, not here, you're not. There is no scenario where you can look at the history of Israel's treatment of American citizens at its border and say that we can make Israel fit into this program. Period, full stop.
Welcome to This is Palestine. I'm your host, Omar Badar. And today we're talking about an effort by the Biden administration to include Israel in the U.S. visa waiver program. This is a program that eases the travel of foreign citizens into the U.S. by exempting them from any visa requirements. But one of the conditions for countries to qualify for this program is a guarantee of extending the same privileges to Americans visiting that country. But for Palestinian Americans and Arab Americans more broadly, and for critics of Israeli apartheid, the experience of trying to enter Israel or the occupied Palestinian territories is anything but easy. Discrimination, harassment, mistreatment, and sometimes flat-out denial of entry are the norm. You'll remember a couple of years ago, Israel even denied entry to U.S. members of Congress, Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar, because of their criticism of Israeli policy. Now, one of the leading organizations that has been tracking Israel's mistreatment of Americans at the border is the Arab American Institute. And today, we're joined by AAI Executive Director Maya Berry. Maya, welcome to This is Palestine.
Hey, Omar. Thank you so much for including us.
Of course. Maya, AAI has been dealing with this issue for a very long time. Before we get into what's happening right now with the Biden administration and this current effort to afford Israel even more privileges, Can you just give our listeners some context about the broader problem of Israel's mistreatment of American citizens and how far back it goes?
Well, first, Omar, I would start by the key point that you just used to frame the conversation, which is that we're actually talking about Israel's treatment exclusively of American citizens. We know that Israel has a history of discriminating at its border, and that applies to a variety of groups. But for the purposes of this uniquely laser beam focused conversation about Israel's admittance into the visa waiver program, we're talking about U.S. citizens, U.S. passport holders who travel to Israel or the Palestinian territories and are either harassed or denied entry because Israel refuses to acknowledge basically their U.S. citizenship. This is happening to Arab Americans, specifically Palestinian Americans, and others who have been advocates for Palestinian human rights. When you say we've been collecting these stories, regrettably, it goes back to our founding in 1985. So for nearly four decades, we have heard from Arab Americans across the country about their treatment at Israel's border and their failure to acknowledge their U.S. citizenship.
Maya, you've laid out that this is an extensive problem that goes back decades. Talk about the complaints that AAI receives. How many of them have you gotten and what do they describe?
Yeah, so a lot over the years, and we've collected them at different times. As you can imagine, in the pre-COVID days, most of those complaints would come in during the traditional summer travel. They range from the most basic, I get stopped, I'm asked where I'm from, I say my state. You know, I might mention I'm from Michigan, for example, and know where you're really from. And you say, I'm born in Michigan. Where is your father from? Where is your mother from? The line of questioning, the treatment, I in anticipation of our discussion today, I pulled some, if you don't mind. There's one I just wanted to highlight. They talked about being interrogated for 8 hours, accused of plotting a terrorist attack, repeatedly threatened to be deported or denied entry, ultimately let in, basically saying, hurry up and do it before I change my mind. All of this done in the context of what they talked about being given the special treatment, taken out of line, placed into another holding room where you're there with a group of other Arab Americans. Some are strip searched, their suitcases, their address books, their computers literally turned around saying, log in so we can view all this. And the part of it, you know, Omar, the key part for us has been that we have actually not been focused on Israel's behavior per se, because we know that each country has a right to control its own borders. And Israel has a dismal human rights record to speak of with regards to its treatment of its own citizens in some regards, and certainly the Palestinians who live under occupation, or the Palestinian citizens of Israel who don't have equal rights. So it's not like we're holding Israel up to a sort of special standard that they have to abide. Our focus has been on addressing our own government and asking our own government to protect our rights in this context. And it's really highly regrettable when these things have come up, because, for example, the State Department has issued travel advisories acknowledging that if you're an Arab American or specifically a Palestinian American, you're going to have issues. I remember a complaint I looked at where a person was really mistreated and held for a long time, denied their anxiety medication, really sounded like a very traumatic event. And they contacted their senator to seek help after the incident had ended. And they were asked, is this person a Palestinian American? And when she said yes, they said, yeah, they Israel discriminates against Palestinian Americans. So you had, you know, a constituent services staffer in a Senate office fully aware that, yeah, regrettably, yeah, that's what happens. So that's the issue here. And it's regrettably decades old. There are patterns and practices that are been demonstrated without question.
Speaking of this, the State Department itself says, and I'm quoting from their website now, quote, some U.S. citizens of Arab or Muslim heritage, including Palestinian Americans, have experienced significant difficulties and unequal and occasionally hostile treatment at Israel's borders and checkpoints. And it acknowledges that U.S. citizens who are on the Palestinian Population Registry can be denied entry through Israel's airport. So in effect, as you mentioned, Israel is disregarding the American citizenship of some Palestinian Americans, and our government is okay with that. Now, you've had many engagements with the U.S. government and the State Department on this. How do they explain that? Why is this okay?
You know, the answer typically is it's not okay. And that's important. We've had Secretary Madeleine Albright go on record condemning this. We've had then Secretary Condoleezza Rice on record condemning it. As recently as 2014, under the Obama administration, when Jen Psaki at the time was the Department of State spokesperson, she's now the White House, but then for back the Department of State, and I quote, "The Department of Homeland Security and State remain concerned with the unequal treatment that Palestinian Americans and other Americans of Middle Eastern origin experience in Israel's border and checkpoints, and reciprocity is the most basic condition of the visa waiver program." So as soon as 2014, there was acknowledgement, this isn't okay, and that's one of the many reasons why Israel doesn't qualify. I'm happy to talk about others, but that's the most basic requirement, is that you have to offer reciprocal privileges to the U.S. citizens, and Israel cannot meet that threshold. The conversation began to shift under the Trump administration, and honestly, I mean, speaking frankly here, it's hard for me to believe that we're having this conversation today, Omar, because I did not expect that we would see a situation where there is consideration for Israel's admittance into this program.
It is certainly aggravating seeing how much ground we're losing on the policy front under Biden at a time when public opinion is actually shifting in a positive direction and becoming more informed. Now, obviously, U.S. policy has always been deeply problematic on Palestine and Israel. But in this case, it's not just Biden's refusal to create any negative consequences for Israel's bad behavior. He's actually rewarding it. You know, in August, when Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett, who, by the way, is even more of a right-wing extremist than Benjamin Netanyahu was, when he visited Biden over the summer, they discussed adding Israel to the visa waiver program. And Biden indicated that he wants to get it done. And just a couple of weeks ago, Homeland Security Secretary Alejandro Mayorkas said that Israel was at the top of the list now for joining it. Something is deeply broken here, isn't it?
Something is definitely deeply broken here. The conversation, I think you've given the right timeline, which is that we began to see a change under the Trump administration. And then when Bennett's visit happened, we had then Department of State spokesperson Ned Price talking about the importance of getting Israel into this program in order to benefit both U.S. citizens and Israeli citizens, right? Like, we want to just expedite this super benign program because it's just going to be more convenient for business travel and for tourism. After all, we're talking about visas that are less than 90 days. So the banality of all of it is like, it's all fine. We can't even imagine why there's an issue until you start peeling that onion and you start seeing the layers in which there has been a historic discrimination. And I think that the comments from Secretary Mayorkas in particular, I found really very frustrating, because this is not Israel being one of the top three countries they're looking at right now. The first requirement, the way this process works is DHS consults with the State Department. The Secretary of State has to make the nomination. And literally the first and most important consideration is that they have to offer reciprocal privileges. And there is no scenario where you can look at the history of Israel's treatment of American citizens at its border and say that we can make Israel fit into this program, period, full stop. And then there are other reasons. One of the key principal issues is also that you have, in order to have a non-immigrant visa refusal rate, so for example, the United States has to have a less than 2% refusal rate for visitors from that country. And Israel doesn't have that. The United States refuses Israeli national visas at the rate of roughly 5% or 6%, which isn't particularly high, but it's above the 2% requirement in the law. Mm-hmm. And what's striking about that is that should be okay, done. So you can't give reciprocal treatment to American citizens and you don't meet the refusal rate. So one would argue, why are we having this conversation? And I think that what you have here is political pressure applied to something that they expect to be low-hanging fruit. And it is our job and why we continue to talk about it, and why, you know, we've raised it at the highest levels of both State Department and Department of Homeland Security, and will continue to do so, is to demonstrate this is not a no-brainer. This is in violation of the entire purpose of the program and its statutes.
Maya, where's Congress in all of this? Is there a role for them?
You know, Omar, Congress typically on Israel-Palestine is just not that great, as you know. So in the past, the refusal rate that I mentioned, the way some members of Congress attempted to address this is by actually asking that Israel not be held to that requirement. But I'm happy to say that today, and I do think that there is a newfound understanding of the complexities, or perhaps the simplicity of Israel's human rights record, that there are people that are willing to look at this differently. And you gave the example of the treatment of Congresswoman Rashida Tlaib and Ilhan Omar. Can you imagine a more high profile example than to say sitting members of Congress were not admitted? And in their case, it was, you know, for the freedom of thought here. They're being denied entry because they're affiliated with an NGO or hold an opinion on the boycott, divestment, sanctions movement. That's not how we think here. We have First Amendment rights, and the idea that like another country is going to deny our entry because of those things is simply not acceptable. So there are members of Congress who I think are going to step up and explain why this is not the right move at this time.
You mentioned, Maya, that it's our role to make sure this doesn't get treated like a no-brainer and that we object to it. For those listening who want to do something about this and be a part of an effort to put a stop to it, is there anything that people can or should be doing right now?
Absolutely. And thank you for asking that specifically. There are two things to do. The first is go to our website, which is aaiusa.org. And there is a form there that you can fill out that gives us, frankly, more data. We don't have to use your names if you provide it to us. And when I talk about these stories, and in fact, I want to read one to you before we close out, Omar, we don't have to give the name, but provide your account so that we are able to document this as best as we can. And then the second part is actually, please contact your member of Congress, reach out to them and say, as an American citizen, I deserve equal protection under the law. And when my U.S. passport is not recognized at Israel's border, then I'm not being awarded equal protection. As I've said, our beef on this issue is with our own government. Israel's behavior is in a whole other category. This is about the way the United States has allowed Israel to mistreat us without not only without paying a price for it, but now we're talking about with potentially rewarding them for it.
You also mentioned that you wanted to share another story. Is this of someone who was held by Israel at the border as well?
It is. It's an American citizen of Palestinian descent who is traveling with her mother and brother to Bethlehem. She's 12 years old. She arrives at Ben Gurion Airport in Israel. Her family was held up in customs while guards inspected their bags and questioned them. She was separated from her mother and brother, again, a 12-year-old, taken to an interrogation room with her American passport in hand. For several hours, Israeli authorities repeatedly asked her questions like, what is your religion? Why are you here? What's your father's and grandfather's name? Do you have any bombs with you? Are you a suicide bomber? They also asked her where she was from several times, to which she replied, America. And the Israeli soldier responded, not here, you're not. Her mother told the Israeli police that she would contact the U.S. State Department about her experience. And the response back was, they are not here to help you. We do this to you so you never try to come to Israel again. Go before I change my mind and let you in. So this is, again, a pattern and practice to discourage the travel of Arab Americans, specifically Palestinians, Palestinian Americans who are denied the opportunity to use your U.S. documents. Literally, they force them to travel on Palestinian papers, even though they're U.S. citizens with U.S. passports. It is a pattern and practice, and it's discriminatory in nature. It's clear what the intent is, the abuse, the harassment, the mistreatment, and then sometimes outright deportations and denial of entry. And it's just it's completely unacceptable that our government would consider this treatment to be allowed by allowing Israel into this program.
Honestly, it's beyond unacceptable. We're talking about a country that gets all kinds of privileges and special treatment from the U.S. Unprecedented military funding, unprecedented diplomatic cover, and dozens of vetoes at the UN Security Council to shield them from accountability, and for them to turn around and get away with mistreating American citizens in this fashion, and not only not have American support not diminish, but to actually see it grow and reward this behavior is just infuriating. Maya, is there anything else that people should know about this that we haven't talked about yet?
The only final point I would make is that the Israeli press often has a way of spinning things that aren't necessarily the reality of what's happening. So I want to be clear, we're not taking this lightly. We're taking it very seriously, and we're having the conversations with U.S. officials that need to be had to make sure that this does not happen. But I also think there's been a little bit of overstatement about what U.S. officials have committed to and not committed to. So I think as we approach our members of Congress on this, it is not a done deal by any stretch of the imagination, but it's important that we remain vigilant and pushing it back and understanding that the political moves to make it happen are running directly into the wall of what the actual visa waiver program was designed to do and the fact that Israel cannot meet its requirements. I'm not saying this just to sort of leave on a positive note. I'm saying that there's a lot of politics here, and the law is written, and Israel's practices make the burden on them to demonstrate that they can be admitted. So just stay focused and offer us again the data on about cases that you're familiar with and bring it to your member of Congress's attention in terms of your opposition to this.
You are just listening to Maya Berry, Executive Director of the Arab American Institute. You can find her on Twitter at @imayaberry, and you can follow the Arab American Institute at @AAIUSA. Maya Berry, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you, Omar.
Thank you for listening to This is Palestine, a podcast brought to you by the Institute for Middle East Understanding. The IMEU is a nonprofit focused on giving you access to untold stories, facts, and expert sources on all things Palestine. For more information, please visit our website at www.imeu.org and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the IMEU. I'm Deanna Butu. Thanks for listening. ما في أقرب من هالباب يعني بلا طول تسيري ما شاء الله حوله عمله جملين بيمرق منه ماشي ذهابا وإياب سلم على كل الجيل سلمني
Butu. The sounds that you heard at the start of the podcast were the sounds of people engaged in illegal activity. Listen again. Do you hear it? Yes, you heard it. Illegal activity. And what was that illegal activity? It was the crime of picking the wild herb of za'atar. Za'atar is a deliciously fragrant green herb, which has been a staple of the Palestinian diet from time immemorial. Almost all Palestinian children are fed the story that eating menakish, which is bread with za'atar, will make you smarter. Za'atar recipes are found in virtually every Palestinian cookbook and used on chicken, eggs, and even just dipped in newly pressed olive oil. But finding za'atar is not an easy matter. Israel's takeover of Palestine in 1948 and the ethnic cleansing process that ensued not only removed Palestinians from their homes and land, but also transformed the Palestinian diet by separating Palestinians from their food sources. Palestinians went from eating locally sourced food to now relying on foreign food aid, and now, even more so, Israeli products. In the West Bank and in the Gaza Strip, Palestinians continue to face Israeli land and water grabs that continue to impact their ability to buy and eat locally sourced food. In some cases, it's now cheaper to import tomatoes from Spain than it is to buy them from Jericho in the West Bank. Alongside these land and water grabs, and in a further attempt to separate Palestinians from their food sources, long-standing Israeli government policy criminalizes the picking of three Palestinian wild plants, za'atar, akub, or gundelia in English, and meramiyye, which is sage. To help us better understand this policy, we are joined by Rabia Aghbariyye, a doctoral candidate at Harvard Law School, who also works with the Haifa-based Adala Legal Center for Arab Minority Rights in Israel. Late one night, Rabia began the legal equivalent of a Google search in order to find cases on the ways in which Palestinians caught picking these three plants are treated in Israeli courts. Now, according to Israeli sources, the Israeli authorities handed out 780 fines to Palestinians picking za'atar, akub, and meramiyye in the wild between the years of 2010 and 2016, many of these fines amounting to hundreds of dollars. Some Palestinians even faced criminal prosecutions, 26 alone in the years 2016 to 2018. At the same time, Aghbariyye noted that Israeli commercial producers are not subjected to the same fines or even prosecutions. In fact, they're seen as doing the work of redeeming the land. Now, together with Adala, Aghbariyye is fighting a campaign arguing that there is no justification for Israel's absolute ban on picking these plants. We'll hear more now from Rabia. Enjoy the podcast.
Rabia Aghbariyye, welcome to the This is Palestine podcast.
Thank you, Diana.
So Rabia, when we first met, you mentioned to me some of the legal work that you were focused on, specifically around the issue of food, and in particular relating to akub and za'atar and the criminalization of picking of za'atar and akub. Rabia, can you tell me how you got involved in researching this issue?
Yes, it's actually quite random, I would say, story, as I was in law school a few years ago, and I just inserted the word za'atar into the legal search engines, the Israeli legal search engines in Hebrew. And so all these decisions of courts sentencing defendants because of picking za'atar or following their picking of za'atar just started popping up. And so I thought, this is really weird, you know. I always knew, and it's kind of a popular knowledge among Palestinians, that za'atar has been criminalized, and akub as well. But seeing these decisions, I thought, this is really, really interesting and really fascinating how, you know, political dimensions and colonial rhetorics can manifest in court decisions on such a marginal, ostensibly marginal areas of the law. So that's how I started assembling, you know, all the legal pieces together. And I collected all the Za'atar al-Aqoub sentences and court decisions that I could find. And I collected more than 60 between 2004 to 2016. And that's how the project started.
Wow. So for those who are unaware, you know, throughout the spring, you can always see Palestinians foraging for different edible plants, such as khubezi, louf, aylet, maramiyye, asparagus, mushrooms, you name it. And yet there are some, namely za'atar and aqoub, which you focused on in maramiyye, that Palestinians are prohibited from picking with the possibility of facing criminal sanctions for this simple act. Can you talk to us, Rabia, tell us, Rabia, what was behind the decision on the part of the Israeli government to ban the foraging of these plants?
That za'atar and maramiyye, za'atar and sage, were enlisted into the Nature and Parks Authority's protected plants list, which is a list generated, a legal list that basically prohibits picking certain plants that are enlisted there. And they were added in 1977 to that list. And the authority to add this these plants to the list is a political authority. And this is a crucial point. The political authority, namely the minister, is the person in charge of updating that list. And in 1977, when za'atar and maramiyye were added, and later on in 2004, when aqoub was added to the list, the minister back at the time was Ariel Sharon. He was the Minister of Agriculture, later turned to be the Minister of Environmental Protection while in office as a prime minister in 2004. So he's actually the only one who cared to upgrade that list between the span of more than 30 years. And in 77, he added the za'atar and sage to the list. In 2004 and 5, he added the aqoub to the protected plants list. Now, additionally, I want to just mention that this list of protected plants and the idea of having a political authority determine it is distinguished from a scientific authority that generates in parallel. Under the same body of Nature and Parks Authority, there is different plants that classify different lists that classify different plants as, you know, endangered or near endangered, etc.
And so you mentioned there's a political reason behind this, but is there any scientific reason for banning any of these plants, any of these three plants that you've mentioned?
So when we later try to understand what stands behind the ban, and I've been working on this subject, you know, for a few years now, in the sense of it turned to be a case at Adala where I work, and we asked for all the materials that were there in 1977 that led to declaring these plants as protected plants, and the answer was that there were no materials, or at least that the ministry claimed that they could not trace any materials. They claim that it doesn't mean that they don't exist. It's just that they're not available. Now, I find it an interesting, you know, claim. But the idea is that there is no really, like, with time, I started understanding that there is no real scientific corpus. It's highly disputed among scientists themselves, among experts in botanical expertise. And even, you know, within the Israeli scientific community, there is several experts who voiced their objection to the absolute ban policy. And so there is not enough scientific basis that mandates, you know. So I want to draw this between the political authority versus some sort of scientific authority, although we know that science can be highly politicized as well. But in this case, it's just striking that under the pretext of nature protection and under the pretext of using this scientific language in courts, we see that there is really a lack of clear basis. And the courts in this sense function as, you know, generating legitimacy and creating some sort of a determinist discourse about what is the truth and what is the science in this sense, without really basing, you know, their judgments and their statements and their rulings on any solid, concrete findings, scientific findings. So I find it fascinating how courts can legitimate and determine, and the legal outcome becomes enveloping some deterministic reality in which the courts manufacture, you know, deterministic outcomes of scientific inquiries. So we see this clearly, that without any clear scientific basis for the za'atar, at least, you know, the courts accept the narrative that picking za'atar is necessarily putting it in danger, without regard to what is the amount of za'atar picked, or whether, for example, it was uprooted from its roots versus, say, picked only the leaves. So this is an important point, and the interaction between law and science in this sense create some sort of a double legitimacy to the narrative that, you know, that this is an objective kind of ban. But I want to cast doubt on that during our conversation and try to explore how this objectivity is actually manufactured.
Yeah, and I mean, it sounds as though, I mean, as you know, za'atar and maramiyye are so central to Palestinian culture and to the Palestinian cuisine. And so it sounds as though there's much more that's at play here than just simply trying to protect a plant. It sounds as though there's something much more, much deeper, much more fundamental there. Plus, what's interesting is that you see so many commercial uses of za'atar. For example, they have za'atar chips here and za'atar snacks and so on and so forth. So it strikes me that there's something deeper that's going there. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yes, sure. I really think the story of za'atar and akub and their criminalization, this story of za'atar and akub resembles the Nakba in its smallest details. You know, it's a story about Palestinians losing control over their resources, over their land, over their culture, over their ability to be self-sufficient, over their ability to produce a Palestinian household, both economically as an economic institution that is dependent on these plants, but also as a cultural institution. And so criminalization of za'atar ma'koub is not merely, you know, this marginal conflict happening about, you know, a clash between law and nature protection on one hand, on the other hand, a cultural practice. It's much, much deeper than that. And particularly this happens when the context in which this is taking place is a settler colonial context, where law becomes enmeshed with politics at such a grand level and, you know, with dispossession and cultural appropriation as well. So we see all these forces at play here, and we see that the ban itself was later used, you know, to produce profit for Israeli Jewish farmers. And so there is certainly, you know, an economic interest that produced profit on behalf of this ban. I don't know to say precisely, you know, some claim that the ban itself was motivated because of some Jewish farmers' interests in capitalizing, say, on the za'atar market. But I don't know to say if this is exactly the relationship, but what we can at least say is that following the ban, there was not only cultural appropriation, but also economic exploitation of the situation in which Jewish farmers monopolized for years the market of za'atar and started selling za'atar domesticated, they call it domesticated za'atar, to Palestinians. both in Israel and in the West Bank, you know. And so this ban is, and it's actually an important point, this ban is enforced both through the legal system in Israel itself and also through the military system in the occupied West Bank. And so we see, you know, that there is here a lot at play, not only cultural appropriation, but also economic exploitation.
Having spent a lot of time doing research on these cases, what can you tell us about those who, and I'm putting it in quotes, get caught picking these plans? What are the demographics of the people who are appearing before the courts, and how are the courts treating these cases?
Yeah, that's a complex question, because when I first started studying these cases, I was trying to understand what is the logic that, you know, organizes all these cases that end up in court, because I knew that there was also another alternative, which is an alternative of spot on the spot fine, to give people simply a fine on the spot that they can pay, similarly to many, you know, offenses or misdemeanors. And so there, what I found is that the group of defendants is actually quite diverse. So we have young people, relatively, you know, in the 20s, 30s sometimes. We have a lot of, you know, old people in their late 60s, 70s who come out to pick. But also we have families sometimes. And it's also, interestingly, not necessarily, you know, cutting through gender lines. So we see a lot of women and men, and there is no clear, you know, policy that clearly, you know, organizes the logic of who is indicted in courts. And also, not only who, but also about what amount of picking of the plans. So we see very small amounts, and we see as well larger amounts. But besides picking them, besides indictments in courts, you know, and all this court process, as I said, there is on the a lot of fines are given, and this is actually much more abundant. So, for example, between the 2011 to 2016, there were more than 750 fines given. And according to the Nature and Parks Authority, which is the body responsible for enforcing this ban, most of these cases concerned small amount. When I say most, they say that only 10 cases involved larger than 10 kilograms of za'atar. And this is only about za'atar, not even about akub. And so we see that this ban and the enforcement, and its enforcement has been really harshly enforced on the ground on people, regardless of age, regardless of amount. And this is an important thing.
And so how is it that the courts are treating those who have been found picking these plants? Is it in the fashion of the colonial, telling them that they are doing something that is wrong? I mean, can you describe for us how the courts are treating those who pick these, who they find it to have picked these plants?
So there is several themes that are unifying or abundant or clear from the analyzing the court decisions. One of them is what I call unfooding process that the courts make when they discuss or try to decide on these cases. And this unfooding process involves, you know, stripping the food quality out of these plants and treating them as, you know, criminal substances. Because after all, we must understand this is a criminal court. This is a regular criminal court, a magistrate court, which is the lower court in the Israeli legal system. And they treat, you know, they bring defendants, and these defendants are accused of picking certain amount of plants. And the court has now there's a trial. There's either a bargaining, you know, a plea bargain. But many times there's also a trial, and I think, you know, looking at these interactions in the context of the court is very interesting. And it reveals something about the consciousness that is at play here, you know. And when especially Israeli judges are trying to to judge these cases, they are dealing with these plants or doing what I call an unfooding process, in the sense of stripping these plants of their food quality and treating them as criminal substances. So we don't see any clear reference to the functions of the plants. You know, despite the defendants claiming, for example, that they picked it for the household, that they picked a small amount, and that this is food, the court does not treat it that way. It strips it from its food quality and invokes a language or rhetoric of national, project of protecting nature. So it says, for example, that the acts of the defendant is violates the core values, quote unquote, of the Israeli society, and so we see a lot of paternalistic language, a lot of under the pretext of, again, nature protection, and a lot of rhetorics that resemble or remind colonial discourses. It's the court who is saying to the defendants, you are, you know, the enemies of nature, and I am the protector of nature. And when these categories fall, again, on the lines of a colonizer and a colonized in the wider context, this is an important dynamic that we should be aware of. And so this is one theme about the unfooding process. A different theme that I would like to highlight is the fact that, you know, despite there is a few cases where the judge was an Arab judge, actually. I don't know, you know, a person who accepts to be in the Israeli legal system might not necessarily identify as Palestinian. But these Arab judges who judge and adjudicate Za'atar cases, the three acquittals were in front, 3 out of 40 cases of Za'atar led to acquittals, and the three of them were in front of that judge. And I found that remarkable, you know. And the rhetoric that this judge is invoking, after all, is still distinct from other judges who adjudicate, other Jewish Israeli judges that adjudicate Za'atar cases. And so after all, I think this is really powerful example of how the consciousness of the judges here at play, that even identity, you know, affects the legal outcome in these cases.
Wow, that's really fascinating. So, Rabia, you've done, I know you've done a lot of work on this. Can you tell us what the status of the criminalization of foraging is now? What developments there have been since your work with Adela?
Yes, so this article or project started as a completely academic, you know, research, and it developed to be a case a few years later when I joined Adala, and we tried to challenge this absolute ban on picking Za'atar and Akub. And the journey here is really quite a fascinating one that replicates a lot of the dynamics of the colonial discourse itself, in this sense, because we see that the after we managed to push the Nature and Parks Authority to reformulate the ban, we see that they tried to reframe it as their own initiative. And so they tried to wipe out any Palestinian agency from even the reformulation story. And the ban has been reformulated now for almost a year, a little bit more than a year, but then the pandemic, you know, kicked in, and we don't really know how this would be enforced on the ground. The ban now is, legally speaking, is still there. It's still absolute on paper, but the prosecutorial policy, the enforcement policy, has changed to allow picking up to 5 kilograms of these plants. And so there is certainly a change, but we're still following how this will manifest on the ground.
So you've, I know that you're in Cambridge right now, and so you've missed Akub season here in Palestine. Do you miss Akub?
Definitely. Akub, Akub is something you can't get hold of in America. This is, you can find some some za'atar, which I don't know because I bring my old za'atar from back home, and many people, many Palestinians actually are familiar with this practice of traveling with za'atar. In fact, Salman Natur has a funny story he wrote about. Salman Natur is the late Salman Natur is a great Palestinian writer who writes about, in his book, Safar ala Safar, which talks about his travel around the world. He talks about an incident, a couple of incidents where he carried za'atar with him actually in London, and they suspected it to be drugs. And so he was stopped at the airport, and you know, the security came, and he was telling them, this is za'atar, you colonized us for 30 years and you still didn't know what za'atar is. And so he really is brilliant in bringing these contradictions and these bizarre interactions around such a plant.
So, Rabia, given that you've taken a look at all of these cases, and we've already spoken about the demographic of who these defendants are, all of whom are Palestinians, are they all treated the same, or is there some differential treatment given to different individuals based on how Israel classifies their identity?
Yes. So this is, as I mentioned, all defendants were Palestinian. And not only that all defendants were Palestinian, in fact, all charges that were brought according to this law were charges for picking, you know, protected plants, were charges against Za'atar, Aqub, or Merami, despite the fact that the protected plants list includes several others that are many are ornamental plants that people pick, particularly Jewish Israelis. Now, the one remarkable thing that arose in one of the court decisions was a practice that the court identified of exceptionalizing the enforcement when it comes to Druze women in particular. And this is really, you know, as I said, the case of Aqub and Za'atar can reveal much, much more than about, you know, societal dynamics and political dynamics in this sense. And when the prosecution came and argued that they do this, namely they don't enforce the ban on Druze women, they claimed that this is because of sharaf. And now sharaf is, you know, honor in Arabic. And here you can see how the state becomes implicated in not only divide and rule. We know, you know, that the Druze community has been excluded from Palestinian community through law in Israel. For example, the major example is, you know, the military service that is imposed on Druze men. That is also, we should mention, you know, that historically speaking, and also today, many Druze people resisted this and re-emphasized their Palestinian identity. But we can see that definitely the state does not treat the Druze as a subsect equally to Palestinian in this sense, and becomes complicit in generating these, you know, patriarchal norms and patriarchal politics, where it treats the Druze women in this sense as, you know, a private familial matter of the Druze man. And this manifests in the decision to impose the military service only in men, obviously, while relegating the Druze women to the private sphere. But also in the Aqub decisions, we see this very clearly, that the prosecution invokes honor and invokes as an example to why it does not want to enforce this on Druze women. Now, this is nonsense in a lot of time, you know. Nobody would accept this as an argument if this was about traffic fines, that we don't enforce traffic fines, you know, on Druze women. But it shows how the state uses its leverage to create a system of, you know, to differentiate and divide and rule in some sense between the Druze community and other Palestinian communities.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds very much, as you were saying, this is very much the Nakba in its minutiae, in its minute details, because it's the idea of some people get categorized in a different status, depending on how, quote unquote, loyal they are, perceived as being loyal. And then, of course, Orientalism and all of the other elements that come into play.
100%. I think that it's not only the Nakba, it's the criminalization, you know, of, it's particularly using the criminal law, which is the most severe, harsh, you know, tools in the legal system to criminalize Palestinians' relationship to land. And this is, you know, the Aqoba and Za'atar are one instance, but it falls into a much wider context of expropriating Palestinian lands, confiscating Palestinian lands, especially in the 70s. We know the famous Land Day in 76, but also, you know, many other policies that come to resemble this dynamic of dispossession and this theme of dispossession that is so inherent to the Nakba in the nature protection laws. So it's Za'atar and Aqoob one time, other times it manifests in, livestock policies that target Palestinian livestock owners, and many, many other spheres, such as afforestation and others.
Well, Rabia, I don't know if there's anything else you wanted to add.
No, I think this was
good.
Yeah.
Anyway, okay. All right. Well, thank you so much, Diana.
Thank you for listening to This is Palestine, a podcast brought to you by the Institute for Middle East Understanding. The IMEU is a nonprofit focused on giving you access to untold stories, facts, and expert sources on all things Palestine. For more information, please visit our website at www.imeu.org and follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at the IMEU. I'm Deanna Butu. Thanks for listening.
So that's it for us for today. You're listening to Under the Olive Tree, the Palestine Solidarity Radio Show on CQUT 90.3 FM in Montreal and on CFRC 101.9 FM in Kingston, Ontario. Until next time, I wish you a free, free Palestine.
Talking about it for over a year, and you probably already know anyway, we've decided not to say it this time. So we're not going to tell you again that to protect yourself from COVID-19, you should wash your... And we certainly won't repeat once more that you should wear a... Or most importantly, that we must keep our... from others. Because you already know this is the best way to fight the virus. Even when you're vaccinated, let's continue to protect ourselves. A message from the gouvernement du Québec.